Hey everybody, welcome to Bash University Live here on Tuesday night.
Take a quick break, watch John Cruises on the Tokyo rig.
Be a part of the show, get some chances to win some awesome prizes.
As fast as you go. You know, we didn't have that back then. And
dude, it could just...
That text thread gives me so much energy. I mean, like, I'm dialed.
Everybody, welcome to Bash University Live. It's good to be back. I hope everybody had a wonderful holiday and a great New Year's celebration. And we had some difficulties last Tuesday. We had some rebooting issues, some updating. How many of you guys deal with that? Every time something updates, it crashes. Well, we had to deal with that, and we're glad to be back with you guys tonight. And we've got a really cool show tonight. We've got Gray Buck in studio tonight, and he's fishing the MLF Pro Circuit as well as the Bassmaster Opens, and I look forward to seeing him out there. A great friend of our show and an AquaView Pro. So we're going to be talking with him tonight. We're going to be talking about deep water fishing, in particular some deep water smallmouth fishing. So stay with us for that. And we got a really cool show. We want you guys to zoom in. We're having a 2021 recap. I want to hear stories. We're going to hear them from in-house, your best moments, your biggest failure, whatever it is, the most memorable moment of 2021. And we're going to talk about our New Year's resolutions. What are the things that you guys want to step up with? And everybody in-house is going to share theirs. I'm going to share mine, how I'm going to approach 2022. So it's going to be a great show. Glad to have you guys with us tonight, and a lot going on at Bass University, but we've got a full house, and I've already introduced them, and it's great to see you in studio. I wish I was in there with you, but you can hear the frog in my voice, I'm sure. But it's good to have you in house, Gray. Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year, Pete. Thanks for having me on, and it's cool to be here in the new studio. I was in the old place last time, so it's a lot spacier in here.
Yeah.
A little different. Yeah, it's a whole different animal. I forgot. Yeah, you hadn't seen the new studio yet.
Yeah, we were close quarters last time.
Yep. You got a lot of room to spread out. I see the AquaView on the table there. You got, look at all the baits and tackle that we're giving away. We got lots of room, but man, it's great to have you. I you know, hope you and the family had a wonderful holiday season, and man, we're getting ready to kick off the new season, man. Got to be excited about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm ready to get going. I actually flew home from Sam Rayburn yesterday. I spent 3 days down there doing a little scouting, getting ready for the tournament that's coming up at the end of January here. So my boat and truck are down there. I'm just going to fly back right before we get started and hopefully get the year started off strong.
Did you jump in that BFL that was going on down there?
I didn't. I was out on the water that day, but I did not jump in it. I just got there the day before, so I didn't really put a whole lot of time into practice. And I honestly didn't know what was going on until probably about 2 days before I started driving down there. So,
yeah. Well, I get it. I happened to see some social clips of guys out in that tournament, and I didn't get a chance to look at how they caught them, because Rayburn has been – like the number one lake in the nation, seems like last couple of years. And I just was curious if they had caught them, in that tournament, but I'm sure they did.
Yeah. It took almost 20 pounds, I think, to win it on the boater side. It was rolling out there that day. There was probably 3 footers. You couldn't really run across the lake and get around a lot. Otherwise, I'm sure the weights would have been a lot higher.
Yeah. Yeah. 20 pounds is light for Rayburn. So yeah, those guys were tested, I'm sure. Well, it was the first tournament of the season for those guys, but I'm psyched, man. I'm looking forward to talking to you about deep water fishing. I know you do a lot of it. You fish in the clear deep water around your house, and I'm psyched to dive in with that and talk about how you're using the cameras down there. That's it's going to be fun to learn how you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited. That AquaView, I've had it for 2 years now, and it's really changed a lot of how I fish and how I practice, especially finding those fish out there and trying to find those smallmouth. It's amazing how curious they are coming over to look at it, but we can get all into those details when we get going here. And I'll show you exactly what I do, and hopefully it'll help you guys catch some more fish too.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear those stories. But well, we got up and running, and I see to your right is our man Riz. Riz, how are you tonight, man?
Pete, I'm doing great. I'm extremely relieved that we're up and running again after last week's miscues and a couple of days worth of troubleshooting. When it comes down to it, we are back up and running, and big thanks to BTC for coming in on, what was it, Friday and Saturday to learn some of the new software updates. And our one of our fearless leaders, our many fearless leaders, Miss Rebecca, you would know her from the Ike Live show, helped get us up and running on Wednesday after the initial debacle. And we kind of worked together on that to get the initial updates done and get going in the right direction. And then Brian came in as the cleanup man and got the rest of it done. So big kudos to him. It's great to be back, though. Even better to be sitting next to one of my buddies. Gray and I, we get to fish together a few times a year. I wish we could do it more, but, he's out there on tour, big professional, hot shot. So we can only fit it in a couple of times a year. But it's awesome to have him in studio. As always, during tonight's show, we're going to have some stuff going on. On the table laid out here in front of us, we got some of Gray's sponsor products. We're going to be using that for tonight's Facebook like and share. That's it's going to have Z-Man products in it, Hayabusa, some Angler tungsten, some Seaguar line. So, guys, it's going to be a good Facebook like and share tonight. If you're out there watching on the Facebook waves, be sure to like tonight's feed and share it. And tonight's grand prize is going to be a Hobie sunglasses eyewear mega pack. Okay, guys, there is three pairs of sunglasses inside this Flambeau box, or two pairs of sunglasses, or maybe three. Yeah, there is three. I misspoke. There is three pairs of sunglasses in here. There's all kinds of sunglasses essentials, utility stuff to keep your glasses clean and performing well. And that's tonight's great. Oh, that's not tonight's grand prize. I am.
Yeah. I promised all.
You know what, though? Guys, here's the thing. This is live broadcasting, and sometimes we say the wrong thing. We are happy to announce a brand new partnership with the Bass University with Hobie Eyewear. And, guys, the prize pack that I was just describing to you, you can have a chance to win that prize pack. Starting tonight, there's going to be a contest going on the Bass University social channels. That contest is follow the Hobie Eyewear page, follow the Flambeau page, and the Bass University pages on Facebook and Instagram. And you're going to be entered in for a chance to win that mega prize pack, guys. It's a super-duper deal. Three pairs of Hobie eyeglasses, and like I said, a whole bunch of utility stuff to keep your sunglasses performing and operating well. So, guys, check the post out. We posted it today at about 3:30. Get involved in that contest, and we are super stoked at the Bass University to announce the partnership with Hobie Eyewear, because these are some affordable sunglasses for every angler that absolutely they're off the charts for what they can do for you on the water. The lenses are great. They're comfortable. They're lightweight. So, guys, check them out at HobieEyewear.com. With that being said, though, we are going to have a grand prize tonight for our Bass University TV subscribers, and that's going to be...
You can win Mike Iaconelli's boat. That's right, folks. Just answer the trivia question. And...
Mike Iaconelli's boat will not be getting will not be given away tonight. But
maybe.
We are...
maybe, guys.
We are going to hook our folks up with an awesome prize pack, and that's going to be a TH Marine and Tackle Warehouse prize pack. We got some Tackle Warehouse gift cards we're sending out the door, and some TH Marine products. So, guys, we'll have a trivia question for that at the end of the show. I've already botched this enough. If you haven't signed up for Bass UTV yet, now's a great time. Head over and get signed up. 60 days for free.
60, 30, 180. And a
Rich
free boat.
Just like giving stuff away, man.
Yeah.
That's phenomenal, bro. I would have packed it in. I just said yes.
Down in the studio, BTC.
Yeah, no, thanks, Rich. But yeah, there was a lot more than just that. Me, Becky was a huge part of it, and you know, Mark Jeffries, although he didn't do anything, but yeah, Mark was a part too.
Well, he's retired.
Yeah, that's what he says. Yeah, I don't know. No, but he gave it a shot. So, shout out to Mark.
Hey, we're up and running. It's good. It's good to be up and running. Appreciate you being there and taking care of all that stuff. And,
yeah.
It's gonna be fun. Fun back in studio. I hope to be back in studio next week. COVID free, cold free, everything right. free.
No sniffles.
So look forward to that. And we'll keep you posting on next week's show.
The intern.
But we've also got with us is Alex the intern, Alex Nair. Good to have you with us, buddy. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing good, Pete. I'm glad to be over here in Indiana so Rich can't give away any of my personal belongings tonight. But I'm excited to be back for another show, and I'm excited to hear what Gray has to say and definitely get into some of our best experiences from the last year.
Alex,
fishing,
I actually already gave away your boat.
Yeah, so. Win Alex's beach towel.
Oh, God, I love it.
And for our grand prize, Alex's Bitcoin investments we're giving away tonight.
We're shaking off the cobwebs over here. It's one show off, and we're really on the ropes. So
2022 is a rough start, you know. Jeez, yeah. Going into it, but this, that, and then that. Oh my God!
Now let's talk about that though, just for like 1 second, because as funny as it is, before last week's show, we had a little conversation going on where, you know, I was kind of giving kudos to where kudos is due to our crew and, you know, Pete and Alex and Justin and, you know, making note to, like, how fun this little run of the Bash University Live has been over the last 2 years and, you know, getting to the point that we're a weekly live show. And we couldn't be doing it without everybody that's watching as well. So you're watching on the website, Facebook, or YouTube, we appreciate you guys, man, and it has been fun. And now that we are kicked off for 2022, hopefully we're going to go in the right direction after we gave away the wrong prize back already.
Yeah.
lots more that we're going to be doing in 2022, including, guys, next week we are live. Now, we had a plan to be live, you know, physically in person, but due to the constraints on us and really to protect the pros, which have to compete very, very close to when we had our seminars, when we had them booked for our seminars, you know, we didn't want to put them in a position where they would be under COVID watch or not be able to compete in the first tournaments, as well as to protect the staff and the students. We're going to be live Zoom. We're going to be live on Saturday and Sunday. Tickets are available, guys. Go over and get your tickets over at thebashuniversity.com. And come check it out. And I'm gonna go through the schedule for Saturday and Sunday, because we've just got a bunch of hammers as usual, Bash University. But we've got Ike, JT Kenny, and Wes Logan on January 15th. That's this Saturday, starting at 9 a.m. So go over to thebashuniversity.com and get yourself signed up. Mike's talking about ripping in the grass. You guys have seen him do it. You've seen him win big with this technique, and I'm telling you right now, it's a difficult technique to mimic, certainly one to master. So I'm really excited that Mike's going to give the goods on exactly how he uses this to win and trigger strikes, as well as his talking about soft swim baits, in particular his new Sunfish swim bait that is out. He's going to be teaching us about that. JT's geeking out on spinner baits and grass. He's a master at fishing grass. You want to check that out. And Wes Logan, fishing bank grass. I love that. I love bank grass. Love the powerful strikes you get there. And river fishing. So go check that out. It's going to be on Saturday. It's going to be 9 to 5. What are you doing? You're going to be sitting in your ice shanty? Perfect. Come on over and check out our Zoom classes. I'll be there. Riz will pop in, I'm sure. And then, of course, on Sunday, we've got the great Brian Thrift. Ooh. And
Thrifty.
I see John Murray. And Thrift is going to be talking about go big or go home. when to upsize, and as well as tough fall fishing. He's going to be tackling that. And John Murray's going to be there. It's going to be a great Sunday class. You can go check that out. And then next, the following weekend, we are live again with Patrick Walters, John Cruz, our own Greg DePalma. And that Sunday is Matt Airy, the truth.
Ooh.
AKA the truth.
The truth.
Brandon Cobb's going to be there, and Drew Cook. Great seminars, amazing topics. You guys are going to want to go check them out. Go over to thebassuniversity.com and get your tickets and come join us. Get your question. You're going to be front and center. You're going to be in the front row seat on our Zoom classes. That's the best part about doing our classes this way. And you can get your question in. We'll ask it for you. Riz is going to be there on site. He'll be able to put your questions through, or you can ask them yourself. So come and hang out with us. We always have a blast doing those things. So that's what's going on at Bass University. Brian, you want to take a break now, or do you want to just jump right in?
I thought you'd never ask, Pete.
What's that?
I thought you'd never ask.
I'm asking.
Yeah.
What are we doing?
Taking a break.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to be right back. We're going to be talking about deep water bassing, looking at them with the camera and the sonar, all the tricks and tactics that Gray Buck uses. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this.
AquaView, the leader in underwater viewing technology. Find what you are looking for. Catch more fish. Have more fun. AquaView, seeing is believing.
Why do you love catching fish and rods?
I'm truly losing less fish.
Is the sensitivity of the rod.
That they're made right here in North Carolina in the USA.
Strongest, lightest rod, 100% made here in Sanford, North Carolina.
From the drop shot rod to the flipping stick, every rod has a purpose to it, and I rely on them all the time when I'm out doing a tournament.
Durability in the John Cruz Worming series, the counterbalancing in the handle.
It's the only rod I found that can withstand my hook set. Boom, goes the dynamite.
Different. Some would say obsessed. There's no place on earth we'd rather be than right here, right now. Performance-driven gear, so you can fish longer, harder. Gills Performance Fishing.
Welcome back to Bass University Live. I appreciate the finger pointing.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
It is. BTC, I need you to move that headset so I can see Gray Buck. There you go. Uh-huh. There he is. Now I got you.
Lord Bucklington.
Well, welcome back. Welcome back, everybody.
And, Pete, what's the throat lozenge of choice tonight?
Man, you know, I'm using a Hall's Mentholyptus.
All right.
There you go.
Dead sticking?
It's the most powerful cough drop that I could find, but I kind of lucked into it because you go into a CVS, or that's where I went in, you can't buy a cough drop right now. Like, the shelves are wiped out. Cough medicine, like cold and flu, all that stuff, just the shelves are empty. And the only package on the shelf was the nasty mentholyptus flavor that nobody else wants.
Yeah.
In cough drops.
Yeah, be a man, dude, right? Eat the mentholyptus.
Yep. So that's what I got. But they're actually the best, man. They're the most powerful. They're kicking it. So, and my voice is hanging in. But man, great. It's great to have you in studio. You know, you're friend of the show. We you know, we love hanging out with you and talking to you. And we're gonna be talking today a little bit about deep water fishing, guys. I want you guys got questions. Get on the IMs. Let us know. We'll pass them through to Gray. But we're gonna dive in with deep water fishing, because my first question to you is what is deep? Like, it's relative, right? Depending on where you're fishing in the country. But what does deep water fishing mean to you?
Absolutely. No, it could be, it's all relative. If the lake's only 30 feet deep, it could be 10 and deeper is considered deep at that place. But then you get it up to the Great Lakes, they can go out to 100 or deeper once you get like out into the trout waters of it, the salmon and all that stuff. But when I'm focusing on it, especially for smallmouth, my key areas, what I consider deep, is 20 to about 40 or so. You can go deeper than that, but that's usually the general range that I'm looking at. If I'm on any of the Great Lakes, it can be Erie, it can be Lake Ontario, the St. Lawrence River, that sort of stuff. That's just kind of my key hotspots that I like to look in.
Yeah, well, I know I told this story before, but there's a lake up here in New York, George, and that's the deepest I've ever caught fish, and I've caught them from 90 to 100 feet at George. Deepest I've ever seen fish go.
Yeah, I've never seen that. I've never been on Lake George before, but how do those fish react when you pull them up from out of there? Are they all expanded and got the bends and all?
Yeah, you know, those smallmouth, I guess they're so used to being deep. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But they didn't seem to be hampered by it too much. Huh. Of course, when I was when I found them that deep, it was quite a while ago, and I didn't know how to fizz or deal with that kind of scenario, you know. So I was in the tournament just throwing them in the live well. But as I was culling through those fish, you'd let them go, they'd swim right down to the bottom.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, it was really amazing. Now, the yellow perch that you would catch amongst them, they weren't so...
No.
They became bobbers.
Yes.
Yeah.
They're seagull food.
Unfortunately, when you hook one of those, it was a seagull food. But, you know, they could not figure out how to get their way back down, and I couldn't help them. But, but yeah, they were surprisingly healthy.
I can't help you, boss.
And caught them on chicken spoons in that situation.
Fare thee well.
But what's your approach to catching them in the deep?
Yeah, so what I'm looking for is typically kind of the topo lines on your map that are just super steep and they have that drop-off. That's where a lot of times you're going to get a lot of the current. It can be, even if it's on one of the Great Lakes, it'll have current going across it, and that's where the bait will set up on the backside. And the fish are just looking there to kind of set up and just have an easy meal is really what they're looking for. So once you kind of figure out where those tighter lines are, those topo lines where you're getting that drop, it can be a ledge, you want to mix some rock in, that sort of stuff, and it really sets up those smallmouth really well. And you can really pattern it once you get one or two bites and run it throughout the whole lake then.
All right, we were going to go and do some aqua view stuff just this fall. Did you ever get up there and fish that pattern that we were going to go try to film?
Yeah.
We couldn't make it.
Yeah, no, I went up there in late September was the last time I got up there. Late October was the last time I got up there this year. And they were starting to get into some of those wintering holes, and I was dropping the aqua view down there because I would find them. Some areas I know they kind of stay in each time I'm up there late in the year. But you graph over them, you see them with your live scope, and you drop the aqua view down. And I always thought they were all smallmouth down there, and they actually weren't. There was a bunch of those like quillback and some other kind of sucker mixed in with all the smallmouth. So what I thought was actually thousands of smallmouth were probably only actually hundreds because there was some other species using that same little wintering ground that was out of the current for the winter.
What does that look like? What does a wintering area look like?
So this spot in particular was between 20 and 40 foot still. But the prevailing wind on Lake Ontario is coming out of the southwest. So they were trying to get out of that southwest wind and were set up on the backside of one of the it was like one of the main lake points, essentially. And it's a big sand flat if you go up real shallow on it. But then even where it was deep, there's a couple rocks down there. But for the most part, it was just flat out of that main current. And they were just sitting on the bottom. They stay pretty tight to it. They're within the bottom 2 feet or so.
And how deep was that?
That was between 20 and 40. You could actually look at them because it's such a gradual slope there.
Right.
They would be set starting 20 and they would come all the way out to 40, and then it dropped off and got real deep, and there wasn't too many out once you got past that.
Gotcha. So when you look for a wintering area like that on your map, like before you even get to the lake, like what are some of the key things? Like you mentioned predominant wind direction, right? Like that's something that if you look at any kind of map and you know what the predominant wind direction is, you can kind of understand what areas of the lake are going to be protected from that. But like what on your actual map and your lines, like what is going to clue you in to say, wow, this really sets up like a wintering area?
to be honest, it's kind of hard to tell that if you haven't been there a lot.
Okay.
I kind of stumbled into this spot originally when I found it. It's a spot they use during the summer, but they're not there in the numbers. And I was checking it one time in middle of October, and there just happened to be a lot of them there.
Right.
Year after year. But this one, it's near deep water, which is key. Mm-hmm. I think they'll probably – I don't know what they do once the ice comes on there, if they go even deeper, if they stay in that 40-foot. I can't imagine they really move around much. I don't think there's any reason to. But it has that option for getting out deep quick. And then it also – it's kind of flat there, and it comes up. So in the spring, they can slide right up there, and they'll be ready to start feeding right away.
Right. So you have, it seems like you have kind of dialed in there the transition of those fish, mm-hmm. when they're going from fall into winter, mm-hmm. right, and then winter into spring.
Yeah.
Where do those fish go in the summer? Do they stay in that same general area, or do they go, way down the lake, far away? Like, how do they move then?
They move and get into that current then, because they want that to help them feed. That's where it helps set up on the ambush point. So I was telling you about that point that comes out there that they're kind of protecting them from the wind.
Right.
They'll slide out in the main part of the lake then.
So what triggers them to go into these wintering areas then? And is it the bait movement first, or is it the fact that they feel like they need to get out of the current?
I think it's that they're going and following the food.
Okay.
And then it happens. They probably feed up on it, and then it's close to being on that deep water.
Right.
Then they'll slide up into that area where they don't have to feed quite as much.
Gotcha.
And they don't have to expend any energy when they're kind of protected there.
Gotcha. I got a question for Gray, for you, and also Pete. What's more important when you're looking for like these deeper smallmouth, or just these deep fish in general? Graphing first and studying your map first, or spending time with the bait in the water fishing to find them? Like, what's the most efficient way to get around the fish first?
I won't make a cast until I see them on my graph. I'm idling with my Lowrance. I'm trying to find all those fish.
That's new generation stuff.
Once I see a couple marks there, that's when you can tell how they set up if they're going to be smallmouth usually. But an example of what you can't is out at Lake Erie, there's a bunch of sheephead or freshwater drum, whatever you want to call them, mixed in there, and walleye. That's when that AquaView really plays a big help. That's why I originally bought it, is when I went to Lake Erie in 2020, we got out there, and you were just overwhelmed by how many fish were down there. So instead of trying to fish and catch them then and taking that time,
right,
I would drop that AquaView down there, and you could quickly tell if they were smallmouth, walleye, drum. And it's interesting because, like, that camera, when you drop it down there, the smallmouth are by far the most curious out of them.
Right.
They'll swim right up there. They like to look into the camera at you. And you'll have one, two, and then all of a sudden they come from all over the place. They'll be looking at it. So, which is really good, because then you know when they're smallmouth quickly. The walleye, they like to do, like, the old, like, drive-by, I call it. Like, you'll see them for a second, then they swim by. But they'll come back through. The drum kind of scatter. They're not as big of a fan of it, which is kind of nice, too. But it's just another tool that I can graph, and then I use that, and it just lets me find the most areas as quick as I can.
It almost seems like that the camera attracts them.
It does.
What have you ever just
put a treble hook on the camera?
Drop the camera down there, use it like a dock piling, and drop your drop shot right next to it.
The closest thing I could say I did to that was I was fishing one on a bed, and I could see it almost with my naked eye. It was about 12 foot there. And my wife, actually, she was running the camera. She dropped that down on there. We had it on there, and I dropped my Ned rig down. And I was using a little bubblegum one. So it stood up. It was sitting in the nest. And you actually watched the smallmouth. It came over and hit the camera first. Like, damn. Just picked it up. This was the AquaView Micro Revolution, the 5.0. So it's a little bit smaller. The camera's only about that big. Instead of being like this full size, it's about that. So he actually hit it. And then he came back, he spun back around, and then he ate my drop shot, and I caught him. Or Ned rig.
Wow.
How about that,
That's
dude?
So cool.
If you go on my YouTube channel, you can see it. I have posted it on there and all that.
Oh, man, I got to pull that up. That's rad.
Talk about the micro, AquaView. There's all kinds of features. Are you tying that into your Lowrance products, or how are you using that?
So the micro, I've only used it by itself. I usually typically pick that up when I'm going somewhere that's like a little bit shallower, somewhere I just want to kind of keep it ready to use quite quickly. What's cool about the micro is you can actually record on it directly. So you hit the record button, then when you get back home, you can plug in your USB port, plug in your computer, and you download that footage. And that's how I did it when I was talking about that one on the bed. The larger AquaView, I usually use like the HD 7i Pro, like this one here. If you can see that, it's got the screen built in, but I actually just got the adapter for it this year that I can hook it up directly to my Lowrance HDS12, so it displays it right on the screen, which is going to be really nice when I'm in my passenger or driver's seat. A lot of times when I'm practicing on, say, the St. Lawrence, there's a lot of current there. Those smallmouth get sucked so tight to the bottom that you can't actually see them on your 2D graph. That's when I take my Go or AquaView here. I'll drop it down, and if there's a shoal that I know I want to check, I'll get in that between 20 and 30 foot range or whatever they're in that week. Drop that down there, and you'll be drifting at 2-3 miles an hour. And I'll tell you, those smallmouth, they'll swim as fast as they can, and they'll be following it. And same thing, you keep picking up more and more of them. I had 8, 9, 10 of them chasing it at one point last year when I was practicing for the pro circuit tournament there in July.
That's awesome. What an awesome advantage to have that. And, Rich, just to answer your question too, and I agree with Gray's, I use my sonar a lot. One of the tricks that I use, especially when I'm on the big water like that, whether it's up there, or anytime I'm fishing deep, is I want to be able to see fish fat. Like when I'm driving fast, when I'm going about 20, 30 miles an hour, just on pad, you learn what fish look like at that speed, which isn't very impressive. You know, they show up as just, honestly, they don't even look like fish. They look like little tiny marks, just little tiny tips of a pencil or something. But when you learn what they look like at high speed, it allows you to efficiently cover the water, because you know, big water, like we're talking about the Great Lakes, I mean it's just acre after acre after acre of water to cover. So I found that very, very useful. And like you, Gray, I won't stop unless I see fish. I mean, that structure has to look so awesome for me to stop if there's no fish on it, you know. But generally speaking, it's like once I see those marks, and then I'll stop, you know, I'll side scan, and you can pick them off, see them much easier that way. But a lot of times what I found too, and this has been helpful to me, is a lot of times when I'm idling, they run away from me, you know, like you don't see as many, at times they kind of can get spooky sometimes. And, so the high speed, like jumping them, lets me find them a little bit more consistently, because they can't get out of the way as fast when you're going 30 miles an hour. But
how close can you mark fish to the bottom when you're running like that on pad? Like, can you mark a fish that's hanging a foot off the bottom, or does it need to be like suspended up more?
No, you'll see them right on the bottom. Like you said, it'll look like, I don't know if I can draw, but it doesn't look like much. You know, you have the bottom, and you'll just see that little mark right there. I don't know if you can see. Is that bleached out on you guys? See it? Yeah, see that little line right there?
Yep.
It's just a little line. It looks like that.
Right.
And that's what it'll look like, you know, when they're on the bottom.
Now, will that mark a single fish like that, or do you need like a school of fish to get a mark like that?
Honestly, usually when you're going at 30 miles an hour or so and you see that little mark like that and you stop, there's usually a lot more.
Yeah,
it depends on your lake, but when you're on the Great Lakes, anytime you see one, there's going to be a lot more. And your cone is so small, so you're just going over one, but it's just letting you know that there's fish in the area, there's life in the area. One of the things you got to really is important is your transducer location and mounting. It's got to be tight, because if you're getting skips or gaps, like it's never calm, right? In the big water, you're going up 2 feet at a time, 4, 5, 6 feet at a time vertically. So, you know, you want your transducer to be mounted such that there's no cavitation. It's getting good readings at those speeds, because if it skips, it just doesn't help you as much. Obviously it takes a minute, a second for the sonar to come back. And And I've had to go in and remount them, re-glass them into the hull, make sure that, you know, you're getting those really, really good readings. And if you go too fast, it doesn't work that good because, you know, you'll skip, you know, your boat will actually cavitate, you know, or at higher speed. So you want to drive just right. So it keeps everything, you know, you get your good readings, but it's helped me tremendously, especially because I don't get to spend that much time at the Great Lakes or any of the big bodies of water. I've used this at Douglas Lake, any of the lakes where the fish really get deep. And I don't know them that well. It really cuts down, you know, my practice time and makes me more efficient, you know?
Gotcha. Pete, so, I actually got a question here on the board that I want to bring in. And I think it's a really good question, relative to what you're talking about. So, Clay, you're going to win a Gills Gear gift card for this question, $25. We appreciate our folks over at Gills. Get your information into Alex, and he'll get you on our list. Clay wants to know, Pete, when you pass over fish and you're going that fast and you see fish on your graph, how do you know where to set up and cast on those fish if you mark them when you're at, you know, on plane speeds?
Great question. And you know what, I'm trying to find those fish. When I come back, I graph the areas, right? I'm using my Lake Master mapping. I'm looking at the details to help me identify, you know, what could be the ambush points, what are the high spots. And typically that's what it is on a lot of that water. It's like a rise on the bottom, and that's going to indicate you've got rocks of some kind. And you know, you'll, you know, kind of scouted out everybody water has current on it. Like you were talking about, Gray, like the current sweeps stuff, you know, and, you know, you're going to look at how the current's hitting that habitat where those fish could potentially set up to feed, you know, the upstream, downstream side of it. But once you at high speeds, I'm just simply looking for fish. And then at lower speeds, I'm dialing in the habitat a little bit before I even make my first cast, you know, trying to get to know it a little bit better. That's a great question.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Question. Gray, do you do any of that high speed stuff? Cause I, like you said, have you experienced that where when you slow down, you're like, well, where the heck they go? You know, do you do high speed graphing at all?
I do a little bit of it. Like you said, when you're at a new body of water, it makes a lot more sense to do that. And mm-hmm. it lets you break it down a lot quicker. When I get to a place that I know decently well, that's areas I want to check, I'll just go down nice and slow then. But back to that question he was asking about going high, when you mark it on your graph, you can kind of scroll back through time a little bit and put your waypoint right on that. It'll get you in that general direction. So like Pete was saying, you'll go slowly through there and idle. You know the general, say, probably 25 yards that you're got to be within. It's pretty accurate, the graphs, even at those high speeds, where the waypoint will be.
It's amazing. That technology just blows my mind. You know, you can touch your screen and freeze it.
Yeah.
And take your time. You can be a quarter mile off of the spot that you're investigating, but you know, with all your options, you can punch waypoints and categorize them and get everything dialed in, you know, and then go back to live graphing. It's pretty amazing what's available to us. We're fortunate. I think we're fortunate. You know, it's allowed me to fish deep more effectively than I ever could before. And, you know, I'm happy to have it. But we're talking about deep fishing with you, Gray. And what are some of the techniques that, you know, when you find fish in right. the deep stuff, take us through, like, your seasonal approach to it. Is it always a drop shot or what do you cycle through to catch these fish when they're deep?
Yeah, I would say probably 75% of the time I'm picking up a drop shot. I like to get that down in front of them. Those smallmouth, when you put it down there, they typically will eat it. They're not usually real lure shy. You got to maybe change up the color a little bit depending on the day, how much sun cover you got, that sort of stuff. Otherwise, I like to, if you get on them and they aren't eating for some reason, I'll pick up a Ned rig. I'll rig that with like one of those Z-Man, the Ned locks there. It's a little bit heavier. It's a fifth ounce. So it'll get down there pretty quick, but you put that on just a little TRD, it gets down there fast and you can put it right in front of them. Sometimes those fish, they'll get used to a bait that's like kind of hanging up in front of their eyes and face. and they want to feed down for whatever reason. So you got to have to play with them a little bit. You say, do the same thing. You put a tube on there, get that down there, put on like a 3/4 ounce weight, and just kind of shove that up in there. It'll spiral down. Sometimes that wants to get them to react to it. But the drop shot, it's tried and true, and you always get bites with it.
Man, I hate the drop shot, as you all know. So, the only reason I wrestle with it is because it, you know, I the functionality of it with the weight and the hook. And I always gravitate to something else. And up there at Ontario this year, I used the Ned.
Did you?
And I'm so glad you're here, because I got to ask you this. Man, I lost the big ones. Like, I caught most all of the fish 4 pounds and under, but the fives and bigger, which I had a couple of those big 5+ pounders a day, I lost them. And I could not figure out, because I'm new, I don't fish the Ned that much. As a matter of fact, they're the first tournament fish I've ever weighed in on that rig. And I'm just curious, what is the best hooking percentage head at, you know, or what's the rigging? How do you keep those fish in? Because I'm losing them.
Are you're talking about fishing out deep with the Ned doing that? They were coming off?
Yeah. Well, relatively deep, not super deep. I'm fishing maybe 15 to 25.
Yeah.
That zone.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's typically, if you get it comes down more to, I think, rod and reel setup. I like to go on the heavier side, especially on the like St. Lawrence and stuff where you have that current. I like to go with like closer to a medium heavy action rod, so you have a lot of backbone to it, but you got to have the fast tips still so you can really, you feel them, you bury that hook up in there. Like I said, that Nedlocks one, I don't have hardly any issues with them coming off. Once you get them hooked on that, it's got a heavy hook, so that medium heavy rod's not going to flex that hook out on them. The other thing that's key is I like to throw Seaguar braid. I use that flash green Smackdown, and I'll take that to either usually 8 pound is what I use, the fluorocarbon leader. That's Seaguar gold that I like. But once you have that whole setup kind of rigged and ready, I think that's what keeps them hooked up more so than the actual hook itself. Those big ones, they always get leverage on you every once in a while, so you can't keep them all pegged. It's a lot of fish that's coming up when they jump like that, and they have a lot of body masses. You can see how obese they are when they come out of the water. They come, like, wallowing. But that's kind of what I usually do for my setup when I'm trying to get those fish in.
Well, what about?
I was figuring the big ones had the mouths that were so strong that I couldn't move that head inside their mouth as good as I could the smaller fish. And I don't know, I was just trying to figure out, you know, on how to adjust. But I had so many different heads that I'm cycling through, because it's new to me, you know. I wish I had more practice time that I could, you know, cycle through them and kind of assess which ones have the better strike to catch. But
yeah,
some of the bigger head, because I was wanting a heavy one, and they beef up the hooks on those really heavy heads. And I felt like, man, I want a heavy bait, but I want a light wire hook. And I couldn't find that perfect combination. So is that a Z-Man head that you're talking, that you use?
Yeah, that's that Nedlocks. They actually take how it's a 1/5 ounce, so it's a bigger head on it, but they put a lot of the lead on the shank of it, so it actually makes it a little bit smaller. So it'll pop through their mouth a little bit better, like you were saying. Maybe it was getting hung up a little bit on them. And I think I don't know what power rod you were using, but that medium heavy really helps penetrate that thick mouth they have in there too, to really just bury it in there.
What's the length on that rod?
I use a 7.2. It's a 7-2. Favorite rod. All it's right. A 7.21 jackhammer. It's a medium heavy fast. Yeah,
them St. Lawrence smallmouth are different. They got like thick rubbery lips.
Yeah,
did you notice that? Like they got, they're like sheep's head or something. Yeah. I don't know, man. Down there eating crabs and shell cracker.
They're beasts. Yeah, they really are. Faces. Oh my gosh, what an amazing place to fish. I hadn't been there in so many years. It was a blast, and they were so interesting that like one of the techniques that, you know, it's funny, we were talking about using the AquaView as a structure, right? Yeah. Because what I would find is I'd put up my Minn Kota on spot lock when I would catch one, and almost every time there was a whole school of fish under my boat when I brought one to the boat. You know, it dragged the fish right to me.
Yeah.
And you could just drop right under the boat and keep catching them. It's just amazing fishery.
Yeah, I was doing that in that Toyota series up there. I think it was the same time you were fishing up that tournament. And I was catching them in that, like, 10-foot range. I was a little bit shallower. But I would pull them in with a jerkbait, and they'd come up under the boat, and they would never eat the jerkbait. And I'd take my drop shot and pitch it over to each one of them and pick them all off. It was like they never saw a bait in their life before.
Now, that's an interesting technique. get them over to you with a bait and then put it down and just say, oh, I'm going to flip over something else now.
Yeah.
No. Yeah.
It's a special place up there.
That is a bucket list place, guys. If you've not been there, any of the Great Lakes fisheries, you need to go out of your way for, because they're all different, you know, from Erie to Ontario, the St. Lawrence and St. Clair. They're just, they all have their own personality, but all amazing fisheries.
Greg, I got
one of the.
Go ahead.
One of the baits that a lot of my buddies that fish up there in the colder seasons, they get into the blade baits. And this time of year, you know, right when the water gets colder, do you use that in your deep water strategy?
I do about when September hits and on, it'll still be fairly warm. Like, it can be mid-September that you start getting them to eat that blade bait. And I think that's when they go from eating a lot of the gobies and the crayfish and that sort of stuff to starting to eat those little owl wives that are starting to migrate through. I've caught a lot of fish at the end of September when the water's still in the low 60s. Like, it's not even that
on the bait fish profile. Yeah,
and you hop that thing down there, just short little hops. I can't tell you how many 6-pounders doing it. It's so much fun. It's one of my favorite ways to catch them. And that wintering spot I was telling you about, that's one of those areas you take that blade bait, just little tiny hops. It's just like, zzz, zzz, and they're on it.
Now, do you catch a lot of, like, off-species fish on that, too? Like, if you're in an area and they're feeding on perch or they're feeding on something else, like, will you start catching those other kinds of fish on that blade bait and it kind of clues you into, like, what's in the area? Or?
Yeah, there's some of that you'll get mixed in there. A lot of times it's walleye.
Okay.
They like to kind of be in that same depth range as the smallmouth.
Gotcha.
My buddy 2 years ago caught, like, probably 3-foot long lake trout that all of a sudden came out of nowhere, and he hooked it and just started peeling line off, and we knew it wasn't a bass. We didn't know what he had, but it was pretty cool once he got it up there.
Yeah, I mean, we've definitely had a fair amount of conversation on this show lately about blade baits, and Pete, we did a seminar on blade baits and just how effective they are in so many different scenarios. Like, it doesn't have to be 42 degrees to catch them on a blade bait. Seems like that's a great way to catch them, and a lot warmer than people think.
It is, and one bait that I have not dialed in, and I want to send it over to you after this, Rich. I want to get to some IMs, but one of the baits that I'm wondering if you have figured this one out, Greg, but the ice jig, the Rapala ice jigs, they're so effective in the cold water season. And man, I have not made peace with it. I have not dialed it in. Have you?
I have not. It's one of the things, guy that works for FLW, Kyle Wood, he's told me about it all the time. He lived up in Minnesota and he throws that thing on Mille Lacs and catches them in the fall. I have not been able to get that to go. I've got in those areas where you're catching them on the blade bait, and I've picked that up there, and I've caught one or two. I need to watch somebody do it, I think, and really kind of get a little bit of confidence in it. Because you can feel when you jerk that thing up there, and you can feel it darting around as it goes down. It definitely has the potential, and you see all the tournaments down south even that Cody Huff has been winning on that thing with his live scope.
Out of the treetop from Standing Timber.
Uh-huh. So there's definitely – it's something we got to put some work into, I think, Pete. We got to figure that out.
Let's do that. I mean, let's do that. We need to have a cold water trip and go figure that sucker out. Because in Rapala's world, it's like one of their top-selling baits. Yeah. Because the guys through the ice in this season, and, you know, even when the ice is melted, like you said, we're seeing guys win major tournaments with them in the South. It's there's a lot there to learn, and I'm excited about it. I can't wait to learn more about it too. But I know I see the IM board's lit up, Riz.
Sure is.
Who's over there? What do you got for us?
Yeah, so we got a lot of great interaction. I'm actually going to kick it over to Alex now to bring in the next question. He's been monitoring the board as well. So let's get some of these subscribers involved. Alex, the floor is yours.
Yeah, thanks, Rich. Gray, we got a really good AquaView question for you here. And this one comes in from Matt G on the message board. So, Matt, go ahead, send in your email. We'll get you a $25 Gills Gear gift card headed your way. And his question for you, Gray, is when you're using the AquaView in current on spot lock, do you even mess with it? Because he's having an issue with when it's down there in the current and you're in spot lock, you know, the current's pushing it around. He's having a hard time getting a good picture out of it. So, he's wanting to know if you have any tips and tricks on how to get it a little more stable in that current.
Great question.
Yeah, the key would be to get your spot lock set up first, that when you're in that current, it holds you actually pretty well. Normally you'll hit your anchor mode or whatever you got for it. And I won't stand with the, like when I have this whole unit, it's not going to be right next to the troll motor. I'm going to step about halfway back the front deck, and I want to be either on top of those fish or right next to them, and I'll drop it down then. But you got to make sure you're on the school where you anchored at. It takes a little bit of playing with, and if you can't get right on them, I would recommend going right above them in that current. Go up, even if it's 20 yards, just give yourself a little bit of room. Drop that down, and then I would keep my nose into the current and just drift real slow backwards, and you'll actually see it. Because make sure you have that trolling fin. That's the other thing that AquaView has that is really important. If you have that on there, when you're drifting, it'll go backwards, so you're looking behind the boat, or I guess it would be in front, but behind into the current, I'm sorry, you'd be looking, and it keeps you straight. When you don't have that fin on there, the camera will just spin on you back and forth, and you'll never get a good picture of anything. But that's the best way I've found using the AquaView in the current when I'm trying to use spot lock, is to either drop it straight down or kind of just drift through that area then.
Awesome. Yeah, we heard that from Gussie as well, that fin on there really does make a big difference with it down there in the deep water. And so another really good question, and this one actually came in from YouTube from Ben Nowak, and his question for you, Gray, was, you know, the smallmouth, they're so nomadic out there on the Great Lakes. What's your strategy for staying on top of them over a multi-day event? Because we all heard a million times, you know, they're there one day, the next day you're gone, catching walleye. So what's your strategy, Gray, for staying on top of those smallmouth over multi-day tournaments?
Your best bet's having multiple schools and hoping they don't all move around on you. An example of this that was the biggest heartache I've ever had was at that FLW title championship up on this Sturgeon Bay there in Wisconsin, that I had an area that it had a really steep drop on this one shoal, and it was loaded. You've never seen this many fish on your active target when you were looking around. There were hundreds of them there, and they were all smallmouth. And the final day of that tournament, the wind changed on us. It came out of the northwest, which basically blew down the entire Green Bay side of it. And we had 5-6 footers out there. And I knew the night before that with how that wind was coming across my shoal, it was going to move those fish. And I basically had the option of going out there and just trying to stick with them, and you could see with your active target if they were there or not, and there was very few there. They would eat the ones that were there, so I think the first period I was leading that thing. I had 5 for like almost 20 something pounds, and I never refound them. And it's what gets hard then when you have those big waves is you can't get around, you can't idle, you can't run like Pete was saying on like a high speed. You're fighting it, you're doing 10 miles an hour,
right?
And it was a hard deal to get back onto. So if you can have multiple areas that you can run to and keep checking, a lot of times one of them will shift them. Sometimes they just move to the other side of the shoal. So if the current break was on the north side of it and the wind starts blowing, they'll set up on the back side of it on the south side then. Because they don't want to swim like forever away. They're still trying to move where the bait is and that kind of set up this.
So how far would you say the fish are actually willing to go in that situation? Like how is it, will they go do whatever it takes to get out of that situation, or like where do you start your search and how far will you branch out?
So I usually try to keep it within half a mile of that area. Like okay. it can be pretty far, but there's a lot of like that tournament I never found them. Like I don't know where they went. I don't know. There's times I think they just go out and suspend over super deep water.
Right.
And you can't really predict where that's going to be at that point. You need the rocks or something down there that you were going to be looking for. So it's one of those things you wish you could put a tracker in them and see where they go, because it would teach you a ton. If you could just do that once or twice and kind of learn their movements and how it actually happens, it'd be really interesting to see.
I, you said a mouthful with that. When you get in the big waves, and, you know, we see bigger waves than most people will ever see, you can't move around. It just locks you in place and really hampers your ability to, you know, you almost have to fish where you're at, you know, or find the different parts of the shoal, like you said, Gray. But one of the things that I noticed in the big waves, it'll chase them out of the shallowest parts of the water a lot of times. So when you start getting into those, you know, and then you guys will probably never see this. I hope you don't. It's crazy to be out there. We do it because we're in tournaments. But when you get into that 5-foot range and higher, it seems like that real shallow zone, that 5 to 15 foot zone, it'll silt up. It'll change the color a lot of times, and you can't catch those fish. If you go deeper and look deeper, you can find clear water and catch them. And so what I've learned over the years is I love fishing shallow. That's where I want to be. I actually want to sight fish for them. That's my favorite thing to do. But when the wind blows on them, you can't do it. So I'll try to find on a particular bar or a shoal, I'll find like little rock outcroppings in 5 and 15 and 20 and 30. So that in one area, even though like I didn't catch any fish out at 30 feet at practice, but when the wind blew that it moved them around, I'll go look at that. I know there's rocks out there. I found them. I'll go look at that deep water stuff. If I've lost them in the shallows, and man, I can't tell you how many times I've caught them out there where I never got a single bite, never saw a fish at practice, but they'll not only move like laterally, they'll move sideways, but they'll move vertically too, you know? So finding habitat in different depth zones has been a huge lifesaver for me. But great question. Great question, Alex. Who else do we have over there on the IMs?
Hey, I got one, Pete. I want to give a shout out to Jason Christie Fishing on our YouTube feed. It's our guy. We did a little research, and it's not the Jason Christie that people might know from the Elite Series and whatever. But, you know, he's over there. So a little shout out to you, buddy. Here's a Founders Dirty Bastard. This is for you.
So not the real Jason Christie, but
well, he might be a real Jason Christie, but he's not that one. It's a different one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Here's to you, bud.
Have a Founders. Here's to you.
Here's Dirty Bastard for you.
Lipton hot tea. Good to have you with us. Alex, you have some IMs over there for us?
I do, yeah. I got another one that you guys kind of touched on a little earlier in the show, but Howie Range wanted to talk about it a little more. So he was curious about the depth that you guys would start considering fizzing those smallmouth in. And Howie, if you would, go ahead, send in your email. We'll get you another one of those $25 Gills gear cards.
Gray, I'm going to send it to you because I have bought this year going to that tournament. I bought the fizz needles, but I still have never fizzed the fish, and I need to train myself on it. So, do you fizz?
Yeah.
Or do you use other methods to protect them?
No, I do. I fizz them. I think that's the best way to handle those fish, and it's not so much a depth range because it varies lake to lake. But when I put them in my live well, they'll out float belly up with how their swim bladder gets expanded. So that's when you want to fizz them. You don't want to just be like, oh, it's out in 40 feet. The fish is in there and he's swimming. And he's sitting down in his live well fine. You don't want to start sticking with a needle. That's not going to do him any good. But when you get
them. So you're saying don't do just science projects on the boat. Okay.
No acupuncture to the fish just for the fun of it. but when they're in there, you'll put them in your live well and you'll see they'll float upside down. So they'll be belly up. You'll see the white part on their stomach. And that's when you know you need to fizz them. That's when you're going to take them, you're going to lay them on their side, you're going to go put their fin flat on their side, their pectoral fin. You're going to count from, I believe it's the fourth spine back, and then you're going to go across to where their anal vent is, and you if you when you get the fishing kit, it shows you exactly how to do all this. You'll go under that scale, you'll pop it up, you push it in there, and then you hold them underwater, and you'll see those air bubbles coming out, and you let that go for, like, you, basically until they start to slow down. You don't want to do it to the point where there's no more air bubbles, because then you drained its air bladder, and it's not gonna, it's just gonna sink to the bottom then. So you want them to still be able to regulate itself and right itself, but when you put them back into the live well, it should go back to normal and sit, be sitting straight up and down like this. You might have to do it a second time at times too. If you didn't get enough of the air out, you'll see they'll be like kind of iffy and going back and forth. That's when I would give them a little bit more, but it's pretty simple. After you do one or two, it's nerve wracking the first time you stab them with a needle. I'll be 100% honest with you. But it's not hard. It's the best thing for the fish. It's better than putting the fin clips on them, and that holds them there, and it makes them all right. They'll live throughout the tournament day, and you'll get your weight and all that, but it hurts the fishery in the long term, because those fish that are 5 pounds, they're 15 years old. Those smallmouth take forever to grow that big. So you want to take as best care of them as you can in your live well, and without having that swim bladder expanded on them when you get it, when you fizz them, it protects all their organs in there. So the delayed mortality after they let them go through their live release boat gives them a much better chance of surviving.
So what do you do if you let too much air out of them? Do you just drop, you put them back down in the water, let them go down to 40 feet, try to catch them again? Like, how does that work?
Blow some air in their mouth?
Yeah.
Mouth to mouth.
I don't know. I've seen it where it happens and they'll be sitting on the bottom. I've only ever had that happen once or twice, and the fish didn't die. And I weighed them in. I don't know if long-term if they ended up living or not. I would assume that, because they say
so when air on the side of leaving some air in the bladder.
I believe that's the better way to do it.
Okay.
The Barb Elliott's the one you would want to talk to about all this, to be super exact. She's the one that works for the New York Bass Federation or Bass Nation, and
gotcha,
knows all about this. She sells those fizzing kits and shows you exactly how to do it all.
It's I actually put her link up, our YouTube link on how to fizz. I just put up on the IM board, guys, so you can go and check that out. But yeah, she's the best. New York Bass Federation, Barb Elliott, she's the expert in this arena, so definitely go check it out. And Alex, who else are you talking to over there?
Yeah, Pete, we just had a good one come in from Sean Lai. So Sean, it sounds like he's been throwing a lot of those black wacky rig Senkos, and he's having these fish just suck it down way past their goal. And Gray, he's wanting to know, what's your preferred or most effective method that you've seen to get those hooks out once they get that hook all the way in their stomach?
If it's all the way down in there, you're better off almost cutting it off. Just cut your line and let them have it.
Yeah.
When it's way down in there, you're going to do more damage. I'll take my pliers, and if I can turn the hook and try to get it to where the barb would release, I'll pull on it a little bit, but I'm not going to start ripping on that thing. You're better off leaving them, the hook in them. I grew up at a little pond. It was like a third of an acre. I can't tell you how many 5.0 EWG hooks that those largemouth swallowed with a Senko on it that I cut off, and I'd catch them 2 weeks later, and the hook would be kind of like rusted up a little bit, and I could pull it right out then. But they live, they eat. With that hook in them, they'll be perfectly fine.
Now, Gray, this might be different, you know, for every tournament circuit, but if you have a fish that has a hook in its gullet, if you catch one that's already like that, are you allowed to keep that weight, or do they make you try and take it out before you put them on the scales?
I don't know the true good answer question. To that.
The weight of a hook?
Yeah, it's so minuscule. I don't think it would matter. It's not like it weighs an ounce or anything like that. It's going to give you that
and
extra weight.
Yeah, if it's already in there, it's probably rusty.
Yeah.
Might be a clue.
Weigh it in.
It's got particles on it.
Try it, yeah. Leave it up for chance.
There's many a time this year I could have used a half an ounce, you know?
Yeah. Half ounce goes a long way, man, especially in this game. But, Gray, dude, I gotta corner you on something here.
Uh-oh.
Gray, we're talking about deep smallmouth fishing. And, Pete, I don't know if you know this or not, but I'm sitting next to a man that's probably made $75,000 fishing Oneida Lake, right? And for anybody that watches.
Hold on, Pete, how do you feel about that? What's your first reaction?
Hey. I made $2,500 this year, and in like 10 years, it's the first time I've ever made a dime on
right.
That.
Nice. Right.
That's improvement.
So I want to know, good because job. There's another guy that sometimes sits in this same seat that also seems to cut through Oneida Lake like a hot knife through butter, and that's Ike. But, Gray, you've won an Open there. You've had I don't know what your entire BFL record is there, but I know you've won BFLs there.
Yeah,
I think two BFLs there.
I have a third and a second and a fourth.
So okay, so he's probably got more than $75,000 earned on Oneida Lake, which for a lot of people can be a really, really tough body of water. What is it about that lake that you feel so effective with? Are you fishing deep? Are you fishing shallow? And, like, what was it that, like, clicked for you at that lake to where now you just – you get it. You understand it.
I've talked to you guys about this before. I've spent so much time up there idling with my Lowrance,
right,
graphing where those rock strips are from the glacial deposits. You find where that is, where the grass meets it, and then you got to figure out the depth that week. It changes. It can be 1 year – or depending on the week or month, it'll be 3 to 5 foot. It can be 6 to 8. It can be 10 to 12. And once I figure that out, I have so much of that rock marked that I can run that throughout the whole lake. And I'm not going to catch them on all of it, but I'll find one or two each day that'll have three fish on it, and I'll catch three off of it, and then I'll go run another one, and I'll come back to that one, and I'll catch another two or three off of it.
Right.
And it's just a numbers game. And I think I just put – it's the highest percentage – deal. I kind of have, when I make a waypoint for one of the rock strips, I'll put one on each end of it. I'll line up with my graph. I have that heading extension on there, my range rings, and I'm keeping that bait in the rock on the edge of that grass for my entire cast. And it's basically it's a high percentage area where that's where they're feeding. That's why they're up in that rock. They're looking for crayfish. They're looking for gobies at this point. Mm-hmm. And I truly believe that's the only reason. It's just I'm more efficient at getting my bait in front of more fish at Oneida.
It sounds like you have like a system for your success, mm-hmm, specifically on that lake. Now, is that something that you can carry over into all of these northern lakes? And if so, do you have like a – when you get to a northern body of water and you know that historically this tournament's going to be won fishing in that 15 to 40-foot range deep – what we're talking about, deep smallmouth fishing. Do you have a system for how you go about that and how you start to break that down and figure out where they're going to be for that day, or is it just trial and error?
A lot of that's trial and error. It's more when you get in that deep water. Oneida's not deep.
Right.
I think the deepest part of that lake still – it gets out to like 20s for a lot. There's one spot that's like 40, I think.
Okay.
It's shallow.
Okay.
Oneida fish is nothing like any of the other northern lakes. Maybe a little bit like Champlain in certain areas of it, mm-hmm, but for the most part, Oneida is kind of its own beast.
Okay.
When I'm looking for those deep water fish, I'm looking for schools. I'm not looking for two bites. I'm looking to find an area that I can go pull up and I can catch 25 pounds and I'm going to catch 20 fish off.
And how many fish do you need to catch on an area for you to say, damn, this place has got them?
Like, now,
they're on it right now.
I can catch one now, and you look at it on my live scope, and I can tell you how many fish are down there.
Right.
I can tell you if there's a school. I can tell you if they're big ones.
Now, how much has that changed over the years with the AquaView and live scope and everything else?
Yeah, no, with the combination of all the technology, it's changed everything.
So is it a size thing? You want to check the size on them first before you write it as a good spot? Or?
Yeah, it's good to catch one, but even when you drop the AquaView down there, you can look at them and tell just by the bulk of them, like when they start to get that neck fat on them, like that's when you know it's a 5-plus pounder.
Got it. You heard it here first. Look for the neck fat.
Yeah.
Neck fat.
Love that.
Kabasi's on the back of their neck, like our Polish friends.
Yeah, but it's still fun to catch one here and there just to make sure and check them. But between the AquaView and then your live scope, you can see how big those dots are on it, the screen, and that'll tell you how big those fish are. And it's all relative to if you're in 20 feet, the blob will be pretty big, and if you're in 40, it's going to look smaller, but it's just relative. Like, you kind of train your eyes to know what you're looking at.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
That's I was thrilled that I did some work at Oneida for the first time this year. I'm actually excited to be back, what I learned this year and what I've been, learning from you talking about the lake. I'm looking forward to going back there, believe it or not, because I've been cussing it for a decade.
Did you have largemouth or smallmouth this year?
What's that?
Largemouth or smallmouth did you have?
I got mixed bags
every
day, but the what put me over the top was just two giant. I caught a 4.12 and a 4.5 largemouth on back-to-back casts.
Big ones.
On on day two, and you know, that carried me through with some anchors to do well in that tournament. So, but I found smallmouth in similar areas that you're talking about, but I didn't have enough of them. Just like you said, I caught them in one vein and on day one, but they weren't using that on day two. So, and I didn't have any anymore, you know? So, I'm going to take your advice and get up there and spend some time behind my sonar preparing for this tournament. And
Ray, is that something we need to be doing on the flats?
Putting rock piles out there?
No, not putting rock piles out, but getting out there super early season and graphing around.
Yeah, no, it helps.
100%. It
definitely, if you can figure out where that grass is growing first and all that sort
of
stuff.
Well, I'm talking about even before the grass. Oh. That's typically when we all get out there, Pete. We somebody sees one strip of milfoil floating down the river from 70 miles away, and guess what? There's 30 boats out on the flat. Do we need to be out there checking this stuff out? I'm talking late February, early March, looking for those irregularities. Is it something that could play in a body of water like that too? And I know I'm taking us in a totally different wrong direction here, selfishly, but I need to know these things.
Yeah, I would I've had much more success up in Oneida than I have at the flat, so I don't know for a fact if it would work, but it seems like that would be the game plan. And you would find all that wood and all that other stuff that's kind of buried up in the silt and sand and all that out there. Mm-hmm. That's like the spot on the spot you would have for the grass bed. And we all have a piece of wood out there that we've pulled up to at the right tide, and you swim a jig past it and you catch a 5-pounder off of it because it's one isolated piece of structure.
Yeah.
Agreed. Especially, you know, the rains that we had this year, it moved all the wood everywhere, moved it all around. Yeah. So it's had to position it out there, and there's gravel bars, and there's isolated wood. There's even some man-made stuff that I've found over the years that have washed up out there. So, yeah, it's I think that would be an excellent use of your time, Riz. But I had a question for you about this year. We're talking about deep water fishing. Are Gray, are you going to be any tournaments lining up for fishing deep out on the Pro Tour?
Yeah, we have Lake Champlain, I believe, the third week of August. No, that's the third week of July. Second week of August is the championship on the Thousand Islands then. So we got two deep smallmouth fisheries setting up like that. And then even this first one down at Rayburn, I did a lot of graphic market brush piles, stump fields out in that 10 to like 25-foot range. Getting ready for this, because if they're on that, I want to make sure I had plenty of it to run throughout the whole lake. That's what I was spent most of my pre-practice doing here the other day.
Yeah. Well, that's good use of time, and, you know, we're all going to be following you out there. Brian, you want to take a quick break, and we can switch gears?
Yes, Peter. It's a wonderful idea.
Yeah, let's do that, man. This is great stuff, great conversation. Appreciate all the great questions, and we're going to be hooking a lot of you guys up with some cool stuff from Bass U for participating. But we're coming back, guys. We're talking about some cool experiences. We even have some video. I think we can share that tonight, Riz. Right?
Yeah, we do. It's we'll talk about it throughout this second segment. The videos, you know, like you said, Pete, it's a little bit long because it was quite a tangle going on there in this situation. But we do have the video, so maybe towards the end of the show we'll either roll it or roll out to it. I know people want to hear your story on that deal, so we're definitely going to touch on it.
The story's better than the video, but we're going to be talking about best moments, our best catches, fails, whatever. Our best moments here in-house, and we're going to be talking about our New Year's resolutions. What are yours? What are the things that you want to pick up this year, learn about, or change in your fishing? So let us know. Let us know on the IM board, and let us know about your story, too.
And we're going to post a
Zoom
link.
We have a Zoom feed up?
Yes.
Can we put that up?
We will.
Okay.
Yep, we will.
Yeah, Zoom. If you guys want to share something with us, we'd love to hear it. We all had some crazy stuff happen to us this year. So look forward to talking to you guys about that. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more Bass U Live.
A moment on the water not spent fishing is a moment wasted. That's why Minn Kota and Humminbird have joined forces to bring you the One Boat Network.
products that communicate and integrate to help you take full command of your boat. Born from our commitment to making the most advanced fishing gear even better by making it work together, the One Boat Network will help you find, get to, stay on, and catch more fish. When One Boat Network products talk to each other, they can navigate your boat automatically. They can give you a crystal clear view of what's below with no messy wires. And they can let you lower, raise, and change shallow water anchor modes from anywhere on the boat. But that's just the beginning. We're never done innovating, integrating, and making your boat simpler and easier to control. All so you can make every second on the water count.
Tackle Warehouse is proud to sponsor the FLW Pro Circuit and is the official tackle retailer of FLW, providing proven bass fishing gear as well as the newest and hottest tackle. Our friendly and knowledgeable customer service staff can help you every step of the way. And we offer free ground shipping on orders over $50. Tackle Warehouse, everything for the bass angler at the lowest prices. Guaranteed.
I have to be constantly on the lookout for new techniques to stay on the top of my game.
Giant.
Some have been more successful than others. The finesse fingernail.
It happens every time.
The chain gang.
Broke it off.
The crow's nest.
Never let go.
And don't even get me started on tackle management, especially trying to stop rust and corrosion. Peanut butter.
I could.
Motor oil.
Gotta keep the rust off all these baits.
WD-40.
Gotta keep the rust off.
Silica, toothpicks, Q-tips, the list goes on and on. I'm hard on tackle, I fish fast, I need my tackle organized and protected. I can't be worrying about losing baits to rust. And when it comes to tackle management, there's only one solution. Flambeau tackle storage systems with Z-Rust technology. The original anti-rust tackle box. Uncompromised clarity. Renowned durability. The infused anti-rust option that is FDA safe and free of harmful chemicals. The organization options are endless, but there's only one. One box, one anti-corrosion technology, one family-owned, American-made brand, Flambeau. Z-Rust Tackle Solutions. Preserve, perform, repeat.